It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. The Earth's climate has changed in ways that can't be put back. And now we're looking at a future that is beyond most people's capacity even to imagine. So how do we come to terms with the unthinkable? In part, through fiction. Writer Alice Bell kicks off today's show with a true story of how just one summer of bad weather changed the course of British literature.
It was the summer of 1816. Lord Byron had taken a mansion by Lake Geneva, Lord Byron the poet, probably to escape a bit of debt and scandal, and he had his friend and doctor, John Polidori, had joined him. Meanwhile, another friend of his, Percy Bysshe Shelley, who's another poet, had brought along his girlfriend, Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin, and her stepsister, Claire Claremont, who had quite a crush on Lord Byron, I think. They had all these lovely ideas of hanging out in Switzerland, and it was going to be beautiful weather, and they'd be in the outdoors, and there'd be the mountains and the lake. But the weather was just terrible. It's debatable, but it's said that the weather was so bad because right over almost the other side of the world, in Indonesia, there'd been a huge volcanic eruption the year before, one of the largest volcanic eruptions ever recorded. It put so much ash into the sky that it then swirled around the Earth's atmosphere, settled around Europe, and made the skies very dark and the weather very, very bad. It's sometimes known as the year without summer, and people have argued that music gets really miserable. And there's lots of paintings that are very dark and seem really grim. Coleridge, who was another poet at the time, called it end of the world weather. So not only could they not go outside because the weather was a bit rubbish, but I think this sort of grimness maybe influenced what they chose to do while they were sitting inside, which is sharing ghost stories. John Polidori wrote what was seen as kind of the first vampire novel. Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin. She'd been reading about Italian scientists in London who travelled actually all around Europe doing these experiments, electrocuting a dead man, which had managed to make the body kind of shake and it looked like an eye popped. Mary Shelley, working from that, came up with her tale of a scientist creating a new man. She wrote what we now see as the origins of science fiction, Frankenstein. Maybe just because a year before a volcano had erupted in Indonesia.
If one summer of bad weather could change the course of English literature, what will global warming do? What kind of stories are people writing now in response to permanent climate change? And what kind of stories do we need if we're going to do something about it? That's what Alice Bell asked herself before sitting down to write a definitive history of climate change from the 1800s to today. It's called Our Biggest Experiment. One of the big surprising things for me is how far back the history of climate change goes. You tell this great story about one of the first people to raise an alarm about climate change was an American scientist and women's rights activist, Eunice Newton Foote, and this was 1856.
With the book, I really wanted people to appreciate how deep these roots go. And so, yeah, Eunice Foote in the 1850s, she was interested in gases and how heat could be trapped by gases. She did a little experiment where she collected one cylinder full of carbon dioxide and left the other one with just normal air and put them on the windowsill to see how the heat from the sun would flow through these cylinders and whether there was any difference between them. And she noticed that the cylinder full of carbon dioxide got very, very hot and then took quite a long time to cool down. So she said, almost in passing in her paper, if we had an atmosphere that was very full of carbon dioxide, if it would lead to a very warm climate. But then people seem to have forgotten about it. And she's hardly mentioned at all until just the last decade or so, when her paper was dug up and people realized there was this amazing story of this American female scientist in the 1850s who seems to have kind of said something which now seems so visionary.
But this seems like the beginning of a long string of pivotal moments, some of which were paid attention to, some of which were ignored, kind of like lost chances.
Yeah, I mean, it is the story of the climate crisis is a gradual discovery, like most science. I mean, the other side of it is that in some ways we're quite lucky that we had the knowledge as early as we did, because climate change is not obvious. Even at the moment, when we can see the last few weeks, I think a lot of us have really felt it very strongly. Mm-hmm. Even when there's these fires and floods, we don't necessarily know that that's climate change. We need science to be able to recognize it as the climate crisis. And we could all so easily have not done those research. I mean, so many scientists who studied the climate crisis up until the 1950s, it was just a weird side project for them. It was like a little hobby when they should have been doing something else. And they could have well have done something else with their spare time than looking over temperature data or messing around with vials of carbon dioxide. And it could have been so much later that we would have had that knowledge.
On the other hand, there are some moments like this 1974 CIA climate report you write about, where there's this searing realization that they knew, and still no one did anything about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think roughly up until the 1970s, we can say it's kind of remarkable that we knew what we knew. And then after that, it's almost remarkable that we didn't pay attention to what we knew.
But why did the CIA even care?
Well, they could see that it was going to have a big political impact. They could look back at earlier points in history where there'd even be even small amounts of climate change from things like volcanic eruptions or period of bad weather, which can sometimes happen, and how that could lead to famine and then fuel other political problems. And they were just really concerned about the geopolitical consequences of it. Mm. They're also worried that countries will want to fight back against climate change. But they won't necessarily fight back by stopping burning fossil fuels. They'll fight back with weapons to control the weather. I mean, we've kind of seen this recently with stories about in Dubai using drones to electrocute the clouds to make it rain.
Yeah.
They were worried that one country would use weapons like this and that that would affect the weather in a country next door. They'd seen about fights play out in terms of nuclear weapons, and they were concerned about what sort of weather weapons might do.
And it is striking how much of the history of climate change is a history of these battles over narrative. So when and how did the fossil fuel industry start really pushing climate skepticism, and how effective were they?
That sort of happens in the late 80s onwards and in the 1990s. And I think you can see a shift from, it's very, very well discussed in books like Merchants of Doubt, brilliant book, it really outlines it in a lot of detail, how the fossil fuel industry worked off a playbook that the PR companies that were working with them had already applied in tobacco to delay action on the link between tobacco and cancer by having lots of questions which were, you know, they were both legitimate and disingenuous, in that they were sort of, oh, what about asbestos? Or what about this? You're like, well, yes, what about that? But that doesn't mean we need to stop talking about tobacco and cancer. The same way people are, oh, what about the sun? Or what about the El Nino effect? Or, yes, yes, but also what about fossil fuels? And they've been very effective at derailing the conversation with a lot of questions and what became, I think, what we now understand as climate skepticism.
Well, I was thinking about this because I think that one predominant narrative we have right now about climate change is guilt. You know, we all know we could have made more radical lifestyle changes collectively, but also individually. We could have not taken all those plane trips. But I also wonder if that isn't blaming the victims, because there is so much power and wealth invested in the fossil fuel driven global economy. You know, so I wonder if we need to tell more stories about the vested interests behind climate change.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and this is very much a well established tactic. The oil companies, PR agencies are thinking about how can we delay action. And we know that BP sort of boosted ideas of things like carbon footprinting and the idea that you as an individual might need to worry about your carbon footprint. They did that because it makes them look green, but arguably it has a really useful impact for them in that it makes people think, oh, it's my fault. Mm-hmm. What happens is that people feel guilty and then they stop. And that's one of the genius bits about pushing the carbon footprinting idea, about making it about individuals, is it's not just that you get lost in the small things, but
it's paralyzing.
Yeah, it's paralyzing. And so you get lost in that and then you forget about it.
So thinking about the climate change narrative today, the stories we do or don't tell, the way we shape them, what do you think we need more of? What stories are we missing?
I think we need lots of stories, great investigative journalism and that kind of model. I think we also need lots of stories of people doing things right. My day job is co-running a charity that works on climate action. Just today, one of my colleagues, we've been spending the morning puzzling over how we can do stuff on decarbonizing the heating system in the UK, because the heating system in the UK is so based on natural gas and we need to stop doing that. And we were just like, oh, it's so difficult. And then he found this story of a project that's happening in France, and it just helped lift our spirits and help us think, oh, we could do something like that. How could we learn from that? We need stories of things going right so that we can learn from each other and have climate action at the kind of speed that we need. And I also think another type of narrative we really, really need is stories from people who are living at the harsh end of climate impacts. So we've seen a lot of stories in the last few weeks about the heat dome. Mm-hmm. I have family in Canada, so I was paying attention to that and hearing what they were saying. Meanwhile, there was huge climate impacts happening in all sorts of other parts of the world that weren't necessarily being told so strongly, particularly African countries. There's so many different African countries that feel climate change so tightly, and people who live in the US and Europe don't often get those stories from different parts of the world that the rich countries too often ignore.
I guess personally, I kind of feel like we're drowning in negative bias today. It's a very scary moment right now when it's clearer every day that this is not just weird weather, it's permanent change. I do wonder whether, I mean, is it responsible to tell any kind of positive or hopeful story, or is it too late?
I think we have to be careful with hopeful stories in that it's very easy to come over as crass. And also, I think that we don't want to make people think that it's okay. I think there's a way in which it's another form of denialism. That, oh, it'll be all right. You know, I don't think we should let people fall into that kind of denialism. But at the same time, one of the things about climate change is it's not a win or lose issue. Kate Marvel, a climate scientist from NASA, always says, climate change isn't a cliff you fall off, it's more of a slope you slide down. Now, I'd add that that slope is getting very, very steep. We're sliding down it very, very fast. But at the same time, there's still always something to save in the world. That's the thing that I hold on to, that there is still always so much of the world out there to save, so much of a future that could still be bright that we can still make. And so that we don't have to just dwell on all of the negative things, although we shouldn't just go, oh, look, it's shiny solar panel, it'll all be all right. Because although that might be comforting,
yeah,
it's crass as well. There are people out there dying.
Yeah. Well, if you were to counter some of our fear and paralysis with a story of a moment in the history of climate change where decisions were made or things happened that really did lead to a positive change, is there a story you would tell?
Oh, I think there's quite a few. Actually, one of the stories I really liked reading was autobiography by Bert Bolan, who's one of the scientists who helped set up the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He's very, very aware that politicians were going to need to be briefed on climate change by scientists and that this needed to happen at an international level, not just at a national level. He worked with another scientist, Mustafa Toba, and the two of them, I think, had quite different approaches. But together, those two different approaches kind of came together and built something pretty incredible. And the modern IPCC, they're meeting actually right now as we're speaking. They're going over, they're finalizing their final report. It's an incredible thing. The number of scientists that are involved that give their time voluntarily collecting all these different bits of knowledge together for briefing the world's governments on climate change. It's a wonder of the modern world up there with an incredible building. So many people working together, pooling so much knowledge that stretches back centuries. I guess that's an example of the things that we can do when we work together.
Yeah, and I love that because it's a reminder that, you know, it may be very, very late and the slope may be terribly steep, but there are things that we can do that can make a difference. I'm curious, what kind of emotional toll did writing and researching this take on you? Because I can only imagine how difficult it must have been to write this story.
There were bits where I did feel quite depressed. I think particularly when I was researching bits on the late 20th century, that kind of last 40, 50 years, I just felt some anger, especially when, you know, they're dead and they can't fight back, thinking, you know, somebody's written something in 1961 and you're swearing at it and you think, oh, that's a bit unfair of me to do that. But that sometimes was a bit depressing.
One of the things I really enjoyed is the way you use footnotes to kind of add a bit of humor and also more suggested reading on the subject. So I wanted to end by asking you, are there two or three other books on climate that you think people should read, like some of the greats of climate literature?
Well, I'd really recommend Merchants of Doubt. It's a great book. I'd also say Roland Jackson wrote a really lovely biography of John Tyndall, who was a scientist who basically said very similar things that Eunice Foote said, but a few years later. And many people now look back on John Tyndall and go, ha, you were the man that got the credit that should have gone to Eunice Foote. But that's not exactly how it worked out. There's so many books that I enjoyed reading. There's a Catherine Anderson's book on Victorian weather. It's really, really great. I mean, there's lots of books on Victorian weather makers that are great. There's also The Weather Experiment by Peter Moore about some of the pioneers of weather science. Really beautifully written. When I was reading it for the second time, I realized that he kind of put weather imagery in the writing. So as you are reading about these people researching the weather, you've kind of got a sense of storms brewing and things like that. I mean, I wish I could write a book like that. It's a real joy to read.
Oh, well, so is yours.
Thank you.
So thank you so much for talking.
Thank you for asking me.
Alice Bell is a writer, co-director of the climate charity Possible, and author of Our Biggest Experiment, A History of the Climate Crisis.